You can hear okay? All right. Well, some of you were not here yesterday afternoon when Connie gave a really inspiring talk, courageous talk. She talked about anger and living in this world and getting angry because a lot of stuff goes on that you don't like. Yeah. Did I touch this? Did I get this going?
Is the red light
up? Yes, now it is. Yeah, okay. Well, there's a new Dharma book just came out called The Truth of This Life. It's a book by Catherine Thanis, who was a colleague of ours at the Zen Center a long time ago. Did you know Catherine Eady? Yeah. She was a great person, very upright, dedicated. She would always say, stay with the situation. That was her mantra, stay with the situation. And she was absolutely dogged with that teaching. And I think that it became the main teaching of her life. Sometimes this is true of great Zen teachers, you know, they have one or two phrases that they spend their entire life developing. And this was one for Catherine, stay with the situation. Don't run away. Don't squirm. Stay with it. And I've appreciated this more and more as the years have gone by. And in later times, Catherine became the abbess of the Santa Cruz Zen Center, where she practiced and led the Sangha for many, many years. And she was 85 years old, still in perfect condition. She went out for a walk. She fell down. She cracked her head. Went into a coma and died. A very good way to go about this question of dying. I think that's pretty good. And Catherine was like other great Zen teachers, like Suzuki Roshi and our own dear friend and colleague and teacher Blanche Hartman, who did not waste her time frivolously writing books and stuff like that. But at the end of her life, her disciples gathered together transcriptions of her talks and distilled them into a beautiful book that is the book of her lifetime teaching. So I'm going to read you just the opening section of the book. They gave little titles to the snippets of talks, and this one is called A Farmer Came to See, dot, dot, dot. A Farmer Came to See. A farmer came to see the Buddha because he heard that the Buddha was a great teacher. So he thought the Buddha might be able to help him. So he told the Buddha his problems. Too much rain or not enough rain. His wife nagging him all the time, and he got tired of it. His kids didn't show him enough respect. So he went on and told the Buddha all his problems. And when the farmer finished, he waited for the Buddha to speak and, you know, say something that would ease these problems. And the Buddha said, I can't help you. Everybody's got problems. In fact, everybody has 83 problems. And there's nothing you can do about it. If you work really hard on one of them, maybe you'll fix it, but almost immediately, another one will pop up in its place. For example, you're going to lose your family someday, and you're going to die someday. And there's nothing you or anybody else can do about it. So the man, hearing this, got pretty agitated and said, like, So what good is your teaching if you can't solve these problems? And the Buddha said, well, maybe the teaching can help you with the 84th problem. What's the 84th problem? The farmer asked. Well, said the Buddha, you want to not have any problems. That's the 84th problem. I heard a recent talk from someone. This is not me talking. This is Catherine talking. I heard a recent talk from someone whose first encounter with Suzuki Roshi resembles this story. This person brought forth a litany of painful conditions in his life and asked Suzuki Roshi what to do about them. Suzuki Roshi just sat there and chuckled. And when the speaker was finished, Suzuki Roshi suggested that he start sitting zazen. He said to him, you're like a clock that's wound up, but you don't know what time it is. So we all know the path, you know. There's no mystery here. Impermanence, emptiness, no substantial self. But the individual cannot do all this. In our culture, we emphasize the efficacy of the individual. We're going to do it. We're going to fix it. But we do not acknowledge or respect the deep underpinnings of our life. We work with what we can see, but underneath the visible are the invisible energies that need time to manifest and become available to us. We can observe the process of an arising self by watching how we crave, then grasp one-sidedly for this or that pleasant or unpleasant experience. At mealtime, she's probably giving this talk like I'm giving it, at a retreat when there's cooking going on and the meals are being served. So she says, at mealtime, we smell food coming into the zendo. If our mind inclines toward that smell, we're going to feel yum yum, delicious, or maybe ick, bad food is coming. When we see from one perspective only, our life is lived in terms of push-pull, wanting to take in things or moments which are agreeable, or to turn away from what is unpleasant and uncomfortable. Seeing partially is suffering. The truth and joy of this life is that we cannot change things as they are. I'm going to read that again. The truth and joy of this life is that we cannot change things as they are. When stuck in past conditioning, we ignore the wholeness of existence. Liberation is to see reality without the leaning of the mind, to see wholeness rather than a fixed nature in any object of mind. The mind will then neither lean toward nor away from things. Moving in accord with circumstances, we do not act on things, but with circumstances. Dogen tells us we tend to reject that which is near, close at hand, and venerate that which is far and unattainable. Whatever seems unattainable becomes in our mind pure mind, open heart, or something else. What is near we think of as everyday confusion, feeling hurt, wounded, restless, or bored. The practice is not to reject what is near, our immediate experience, nor what is far, our dreams, our passions, our idealizations. but to become proficient in both the near and the far. We practice to know all of it in order not to be caught by any of it. Please use your time to develop an insatiable appetite for inner awareness, to become proficient with this mind. Notice what you are willing to pay attention to. We give you all these practices to push you. If they were easy, they wouldn't be worth doing. So I guess this is another way that Catherine has of saying, stay with the situation. It's true, isn't it? We're always trying to solve problems. We come to the Dharma Hall figuring we can solve our problems with a little meditation or even lots of meditation. Because we don't really want to accept our problems. We do want to run away, and we are squirming. And, you know, it's no wonder in these modern times that we're all so arrogant to think that if there's a problem, we can solve it. Because we're smart, we're strong, we got a lot of resources, we can solve it. So it's sort of understandable that in modern times, you know, we would feel this way, because we have solved so many things and created so many wonderful things. But it's sort of startling to realize that even in the time of the Buddha, a farmer would think that he could solve his problems too and be frustrated, like us, when it turns out he can't. Because the truth is, life is already a problem. Just being alive is a big problem. Not to worry, the problem will solve itself soon enough. So in a way, you know, there's really nothing to worry about. Did you ever think of that? You know, I have this problem and that problem and that problem. What's the alternative? I could be dead. I would have none of these problems. Well, thank God for these problems. Every one of them is a sign that I'm alive. So why don't we then be a little more grateful for our human problems and not be complaining so much? Now, this seems like a pretty simple teaching, you know, that maybe your grandmother gave you. My grandmother gave me this teaching. But it's a little more profound than that. I mean, it is that simple, and also it's more profound than that. Because in order to really and truly accept this problem of our life, we have to really see and feel our life as it is, to use Catherine's phrase. And to do that, we have to go beyond ourself. And just as she writes, appreciate the deep underpinnings of our life and take the time to allow the invisible energies to arise in us. That's why we have to sit and to engage in the many other practices that we do to take us beyond our little needful selves out into deeper waters where we can splash around together on the surface and once in a while dive down deep. The truth and joy of this life is that we cannot change things as they are. That we cannot change things as they are is the truth and the joy of our life. You may doubt this. Of course, naturally, we can change a lot of things. We all know this. We can improve many things. We're not the same as earthworms or houseflies who just buzz around forever without any skills or capacities to change the environment they're living in. We can change the environments we're living in, both inside and outside environments. But when Catherine says things as they are, she isn't talking about ordinary conditions, which, yes, of course, sometimes can be changed. She's talking about ultimate conditions, our humanness, our radical temporariness, our fundamental vulnerability, and our embeddedness in a world that is not other than ourselves. Focusing on ordinary circumstances and completely forgetting about ultimate circumstances is really the reason why we suffer. What would it be like to find joy and truth in things as they are? And if we're going to change things not merely to suit ourselves and our preconceptions about how things ought to be, not so that we can get the world organized to our liking, which we're never going to be able to do anyway, but because this is what we human beings do. We are creatures who speak and think and act in the world, inspired, we hope, by the biggest possible picture of our lives, a picture that doesn't just have a picture of me, but that includes everything and everyone. So I have another Zen colleague who also has a book that's not quite out yet, but pretty soon, I think May 1st. But I get all these books, you know, in advance because I write blurbs. I'm like a this is my best literary form. I'm an expert blurb writer. I don't know how many blurbs I write of, but I'm constantly writing a blurb. I never say no. I should say no, but I never say no. So I have to read the book, right? So I'm talking about a book and say, what book? It's not out yet. Oh, right, it's not out yet. Anyway, this one's coming out May 1st by Joan Halifax. Standing at the Edge is the name of this book. And it has a very powerful and interesting thesis that I think comes from Joan's own life experience. The thesis is that the best and most heroic qualities that we're capable of, and she discusses six such qualities: altruism, empathy, integrity, respect, engagement, compassion. She says, she refers to these qualities as edge states. That's why standing at the edge. These are edge states. And it means to her that these states require courage in order to manifest them. But because they're edge states, you could fall off the edge. So they're dangerous also. Like, you know, she in the beginning of the book, she writes about walking on a narrow mountain ridge. You know, one false step and you fall, you hurt yourself. And you can see how this could be, you know, like you could see how you could overdo altruism and become, you know, burned out. You could overcome empathy and just be flooded with everybody's problems. You could overdo your integrity and become like a self-righteous person that nobody wants to talk to. You could be hysterical about your engagement. So the book consists of Joan talking about all these edge states and what it would be like to develop them and what would happen and how could we deal with it if we fall off the edge. And Joan, you know, is an anthropologist. You know, she trained in anthropology, got a doctorate in that, and she's got a lot of scientific knowledge and follows science. So she does all this, has kept up with this as well as being a Zen teacher. So she knows about all this stuff that I have like a very, my scientific aptitude and knowledge is like around Neanderthal or so, maybe a little later than that, like maybe, you know, the 6th century or something like that. So I learned a lot, you know, from reading her book, because I don't know anything about all this stuff. Everybody reads about the brain science of meditation and all that. I don't know anything about any of that. Anyway, so I want to focus on this quality of integrity. which she says, she defines this as a kind of moral uprightness. So we think about what we're doing, and we think about the world, and we think about, you know, what is good and right. And in Buddhist terms, what's good and right is what does not produce suffering, what produces goodness for people and not suffering. And we think about what's not good and what's not right, and that's the opposite. What causes suffering to other people or to ourselves is not good. So integrity is not only having the ability to discern what's good and what's not good, but having the courage to live your life according to that sense of what's right and wrong. And she says, to live your life with courage and optimism. So this in itself is kind of an interesting point. That if you're a person of integrity, there's always a sense of optimism. I would prefer to use the word hopefulness. If you are a person of integrity, you always live with hopefulness, even in desperate situations. Because when you feel that you are upholding the human commitment, which I think every human being, deep down, you know, wants to do good and alleviate suffering, when you feel like you're living so that you're upholding that, you have a certainty that something good always comes of that conduct full of integrity. And the Buddha taught that, you know, about karma. You have real hopefulness and confidence that something always good comes from goodness. Even if you lose the battle, even if you lose the whole war, something good always comes from integrity. I think that the truest and the most encouraging thing that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. ever said was when he said that the long moral arc of the universe bends toward the good. And I think he said this, you know, not because he was hopeful that this was true. I think he somehow knew this. Just like that famous moment, we've all seen it, when he says, I have seen the top of the mountain, you know. He saw, I think, through the lens of his deep religious faith, that this was true. Anyway, Joan has been herself a person of great integrity and a strong activist all her long life, from the early 1960s when she joined many other people who went down south to help in the civil rights movement. Probably her activism is why she eventually took up Buddhist practice as a way of sustaining that heart of an activist. So integrity. Integrity is good and necessary for us, I think. But it's an edge, and you can fall off the edge. And then she talks about four kinds of moral suffering that can come into your life as a result of your integrity. Moral distress, moral injury, moral outrage, and moral apathy. So I'm thinking about these four kinds of moral suffering because it looks like events in our crazy and painful world these days are causing a lot of us to fall off the edge of our integrity into one or more kinds of these moral sufferings. And this is what Connie was talking about yesterday. You could feel the suffering when she spoke. So I'll define, give you Joan's definitions of these four kinds of moral suffering very briefly. So moral distress happens when you see something wrong and you really want to correct it, but you can't. You can't do anything, either because of something in you, lack of courage or something outside you. You can't do anything about it. So you feel moral distress. moral injury is a more lasting form of suffering that's caused by your participation, your direct participation in a harmful action. So it's a serious psychological wound. You feel guilt, you feel dread, you feel shame. This is something that maybe soldiers know about when they come back from battle. Maybe law enforcement people might feel this kind of moral injury because of something that they have had to do in the line of duty. Or maybe it could be a person in a helping profession who might feel moral injury if she or he made some kind of mistake that caused harm. This happens a lot, you know. So people can have moral injury, a serious trouble. Moral outrage is our profound sense of indignation, maybe even to the point of strong anger and even disgust at people whom we perceive as causing harm. This is really painful and disturbing, but sometimes it's a good thing when it rouses us and forces us, you know, out of the pain of it to do actions that need to be done for the good. So it can have a good effect. But it's very painful, moral outrage, really painful, and it's hard to sustain. In Dharma practice, we are practicing, you know, with our whole being, with our mind, with our heart, with our body, with our breath, to see beyond our small, frightened views to a wide and embracing perspective. We want to see, like we studied in our story yesterday, you know, the true nature of suffering that comes from out of the blue. The true shape of it. And to understand in our whole body, not just as an idea, but in our whole body, that all harmful actions that cause suffering come from suffering. And eventually, we can transform our moral outrage into compassion. Maybe we still work hard for the good, but now with a lot more patience and calmness and with love for all concerned, because everybody's a victim. Everybody is us. It takes a long time to develop this feeling, and maybe we never do. Maybe we never do. But we point ourselves in that direction, and we forgive ourselves when we fall short of it, which we will do. The fourth kind of moral suffering maybe is the worst. Moral apathy. Sometimes too much moral outrage will bring us to moral apathy if it goes on and on too long. Moral apathy is what happens when we're so overwhelmed by the suffering that we can no longer pay attention to it. We feel numb. Or maybe we can't ever even allow ourselves to see what's happening, to even feel it in the first place. So we never feel the suffering. We're in total and complete denial. We can't pay attention, or we won't pay attention. And if you believe, and I think you can discover this to be true just by looking at your own heart, if you believe that every human being naturally wants to be good, then you understand that the only way that anyone could ever inflict harm on another is because that person is suffering from moral apathy. It can't be really a choice. So, like Connie was saying yesterday, and like many of you are also thinking, I'm sure, about the horrible, upsetting school shootings in Parkland in Florida. I was just there, about a block away from that place, where I have a dear cousin of mine who's in probably the last days or weeks of his life, suffering from pancreatic cancer. I was there visiting him a few weeks before this happened in his neighborhood. So it's been horrible to contemplate this and all the upsetting discussion about guns that has followed it. So many of these shootings, it's really exactly too much, more than too much. And so when I was reflecting on these four kinds of moral suffering, I realized, you know what? I think that I'm suffering from all these four forms of moral suffering. I definitely feel moral distress because this is my society. I live in this society. And I can't do anything to change this. And I think I feel moral injury. That's not just with this incident, but it's been growing over the last few years because I'm an old white guy with a beautiful, wonderful life. And that's probably the case that I'm going to die without ever experiencing any serious economic or social suffering. And I haven't really been an activist. I haven't really been out there, you know, trying to make the world better. I've just been sitting around, literally sitting around for most of my life, enjoying myself. And so, actually, I feel somehow guilty and complicit because I have been able to live with ease in a society that is pretty much set up for me to live with nice ease and set up so that many other people cannot live with ease, so that I can. So I actually feel a sense of moral injury about that. Lately, I've been feeling a certain amount of moral outrage, too, at the words and actions of some of the people in the professional gun lobby and at some of the words and deeds of our president, who are saying and advocating for things that they're either serious about, which makes it really terrible that they should be serious about such things, or they're not serious about them and they're just using them as a way of avoiding doing anything, which is maybe even worse, morally worse. To me, and I've tried to like look into this as much as I could, but to me it seems clear that school shootings and all the other kinds of mass shootings, like, don't go out of your house, you know? Don't go to a concert. Don't go to a workplace. Don't go to a school. Don't go to a movie theater. It seems clear that all these mass shootings are not a mental health problem. They're not a security problem. We need better security. They are a social problem, a symptom of the broken world that we have collectively made. And the way this symptom plays out has everything to do with the availability of guns. As we know, stuff like this does not happen anywhere else in the world with anything like the rate that it happens here. Less assault weapons, less weapons with large magazines so you can shoot a lot of bullets all at the same time. Less of those, less mass killings. I mean, I think it really is that simple. Now, so I looked into this, and I know it's complicated, because mass shootings, although we read about them and we're freaked out by them and upset by them, actually, the total number of gun deaths in our country, it's a small percentage. Most gun deaths do not happen with automatic weapons or in mass. They happen in people's homes. People commit suicide. People shoot their family members, their friends. There are gang killings. So somebody might argue that calling for stricter gun laws now is just an emotional response to a spectacular event, and it really won't reduce gun deaths that much. But I don't think that's the point. Unless we do something significant to say, as a society, that we are so horrified and morally wounded by these shootings, and that we will not accept that this simply goes on without our addressing it somehow, that we will not accept that we're just going to slowly slide down and down and down into moral apathy, which will become a general condition of our society. We're not going to do that. We cannot do that. So far, I've never seen a study that measures the social effect of a rising tide of goodness and compassion in a society. Probably no study is going to be able to show this. And that's because you do something good, not because sociological studies have proved it will be effective. This sort of somehow misses the point, right? You do something good because it's good, and you ought to do it. Also, I have a friend named Sean Thackeray, who's a brilliant person. He's a winemaker. He makes great wine. He has this little wine. He's like a world famous winemaker, you know, in his little shop. You know, he does it all by himself. He's also like a brilliant person who speaks about four or five different languages, who has one of the greatest wine libraries in the world that has to be like, temperature controlled, because some of the volumes in the wine library are like 500-600 years old. He went into a study of the Second Amendment. He studied the 18th century meanings of the words of the Second Amendment and the sociological and historical surround. And he proved, at least to my satisfaction, because people say this is what the founders originally meant. He pretty much proves, and I think he has a Facebook post on this, if you ever could find it, that this is not what they meant. This is not what they meant. And even if there were a clear and absolute constitutional right to bear arms, every right is routinely shaped by law when my right is your harm. That's why we have governments and laws. In any case, we should also notice the fact that the right to bear arms, assuming there is such a right, actually seems to amount to a right to bear arms for some people. So far, it's been suggested that we should arm people in schools because schools are dangerous and we should protect children. So far, I have not heard any kind people suggest that we donate a whole bunch of weapons to all the good people in the inner cities so that they can protect themselves against gun violence. So far, nobody's suggesting that we arm the inner cities. In other words, it turns out that the right to bear arms really more or less means the right of white people to bear arms. So I'm glad, and probably you are too, that the students at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School are expressing their moral outrage. And they are, along with the rest of the country, even including the gun lobby people, the whole country is experiencing moral suffering, moral distress, moral injury, moral outrage, and moral apathy. The whole country is. when things like this happen, we are sick at heart, as we should be. Maybe this time, because we've come to this point and because these students are speaking up, maybe it'll be different. But even if there is no progress at all on getting rid of assault weapons and high magazine weapons. By the way, there's millions and millions of these weapons here now. So even if they got rid of, from going forward, every one, we wouldn't really be able to see the effects of it until all the ones that are now in people's possession are all gone, which eventually they'll be gone, right? Eventually they'll break or something. Each one will break down. They'll get rusty, right? They'll get lost in somebody's attic. Eventually they'll all go away. But that'll take a really long time. But even if we had these limits on these kind of weapons, even if we are unsuccessful in getting these kind of limits, the day will come. It will. When we will not think that it's a really good idea for everybody to have these kind of, not everybody, but many people to have these kind of weapons. Because of what Dr. King said, because the long moral arc of history bends toward the good. Who knows how much longer it takes till we see that day, but it doesn't matter. We keep on bringing this up. Because we don't want this kind of horror in our world. It won't happen just automatically. It won't happen naturally. It won't happen as an act of God. It'll happen because we will keep on insisting on it until it happens. Social change is really hard. Passing a law in a complicated society like ours is really difficult, as we're seeing. And even when you pass a law, don't throw a party too soon. Because you never know what the actual effects of a well-intentioned law are going to be. Probably every single good law leads to unexpected bad consequences. So let's not kid ourselves. Social change is necessary and we have to work for it. But it's difficult and it is always full of disappointments and reversals. There's no way around this. So we should not naively imagine that this or that law is going to make the world we want. In a way, you know, guns are like alcohol. You know, a lot of people's lives are ended and ruined by guns, so are a lot of people's lives ended and ruined by alcohol, which is a dangerous and destructive substance. But alcohol will never be eliminated. We tried to, remember? You don't remember, but somebody remembers. Somebody remembers when we tried to eliminate alcohol. And that didn't work out very well because, you know, it's not really a good idea. It would be a good idea if you could do it, but it doesn't really work. And besides that, with all the bad things about alcohol, there's nice things about alcohol. It's a culture, just like they say about guns, you know. I mean, I live in California, right, near the wine country. One of my best friends is a winemaker. And you know, wine culture is very nice, a good food and wine everybody likes. It's a big part of our local economy and identity in California. I have a good friend, Fenton Johnson, who's a wonderful writer. He's from Kentucky, bourbon country. His family has been making bourbon for hundreds of years. It's a way of life. It's an identity. So, same with guns. But we do regulate and control alcohol the best we can. It hasn't prevented deaths from alcoholism, broken families, and pain. But we do our best. So let's not pretend that There will no longer be gun deaths someday. Guns are going to be around. Nobody's going to take anybody's guns away from anybody. But they can be regulated. We can do better, right? We can do better. And we have to do something. Our integrity, individually and collectively, depends on it. So also in the news the other day was the death of Billy Graham, who was not... I didn't really pay that much attention to Billy Graham, to be honest with you. He was not my favorite spiritual leader. But, you know, all my entire life, you know, I always knew about Billy Graham. And I read something about him that I didn't quite realize. I never thought about this. You know, they were writing about him after he died. In the late 1970s, when evangelical Christians were being recruited by the Republican right, of course they were trying to recruit Billy Graham. It would have been great for them if Billy Graham would have been part of the coalition. But he didn't want to join. And it wasn't, I think, because he disagreed with their agenda. I don't know if he disagreed with their agenda. He might not have. But the reason that he didn't want to join them was that he believed that peace and harmony and fairness would not be achieved by religions joining forces with mass political movements, but rather by the turning of individual hearts, one by one by one, till the aggregate of human goodness would just be so strong that it would overwhelm human confusion. And so, instead of joining the coalition and becoming a political religious leader like his son is, he decided that he would just preach to as many people as he could possibly preach to. And he reached millions of people, many, many millions of people. So I was thinking about this and I thought, you know, it kind of makes sense what he's saying. And that's really why we're here this weekend. Somebody might show up and say, shame on you people. You just wasted nearly 3 days, you know, doing nothing, pampering yourselves, breathing, while the world is burning up and falling down, and people are in need, all those 3 days, need of you to help them. Possibly those people are right. Certainly we are obliged to act socially and politically to ensure that suffering is reduced. But when we do that, we have to watch out that we're not spun around and activated by buzzwords and surface positions on complicated issues. As practitioners, we should have a different approach, a loving approach that honors all sides, even if we have to admit once in a while we have a little bit of moral outrage and anger when we see something happening. And then maybe we express that. But even then, we have to think again and imagine the views of people that we really disagree with. There's a reason why they feel that way. What is that reason? We should want to know. And we should understand. So bodhisattva practice is to take responsibility to be an ordinary citizen in an imperfect world. But I think that Billy Graham is right. That is not enough. That is not the answer to anything. That's one answer. We need both approaches. Yes, let's work to change society as best we can, but let's realize that that is a tragic affair. But let's also work to change the human heart as well. That means your heart, my heart, every heart. When my heart changes and I interact with you, your heart changes. When your heart changes and you interact with the people around you, their heart changes. So Billy Graham, they say, preached to maybe 200 million people. I don't think that every day's end so far has reached 200 million people. And actually, we're not trying to reach. This is not the way we would do it if we were trying to reach 200 million people. We're not. Our way of practice is very modest. We're just doing our practice, but we are always ready and open to helping other people to practice in whatever way they want to practice, if we can. Because the world is never going to be as peaceful and just as we want it to be. But it can be a lot more peaceful and just than it is now. And that's going to happen. And it's going to happen not because it will be mandated by law. It'll happen because little by little by little, and it's happening now in our lifetime, little by little by little, people will care about one another more and more, and they will not tolerate anything less than justice and peacefulness. Someday, goodness, not narrow-minded self-centeredness, will be the norm. And narrow-minded self-centeredness will always exist, but it will be on the margins. So I'm going to close with a brief passage again from Catherine's book. Loving the world as it is. Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, describes Zazen as unfabricated, clear seeing, unconstructedness in stillness. He further describes Zazen as self-fulfillment or self-enjoyment, the self receiving and accepting its function. The self receiving and accepting its function. The self receives its own freedom, its own contraction and relaxation, absorption and release in the fulfillment of this meditation practice. Practice is about penetrating the membrane of mentality that's between us and our life. It's meeting something beyond what the mind knows. Meeting with our body, with our senses, our skin, our ears. We accomplish this when we trust ourselves enough to drop off what the mind knows. It is unconstructed stillness which receives the benefit of this activity. Because it is unconstructed, it does not appear within perception. Hence, the deep and subtle work of practice is mysterious and unrecognizable to consciousness. Recently, I have come to realize that our work is to love the world just as it is. Because our discriminating mind is constantly thinking of improvements for the world, to love the world as it is means to completely accept all of our thoughts, even the ones that are negative and difficult, and also to accept all of our regrets about how the world is. Loving the world as it is being willing to be in the only world we know. And this is really the point of our practice. So thank you all very much for coming and listening. Those of you who made the trek over the Dharma Hall this morning, thanks to all of you who are sitting over the weekend. Thanks to our Shuso and teacher Tim and the whole Sangha for doing such a great job of helping us all to love the world as it is. Big job. May our intentions equally